You're listening to Wide Margins, Episode 7, The Prophetess and the Assassin. We're going to continue our study on the Book of Judges, but before we do that, let me say a couple of things. First of all, I want to say thank you to everybody for your kind words. Your feedback on the podcast has been very helpful. Doing a podcast is a lot different than speaking to a live audience, as you probably know, or you could guess. I mean, when you're in the room with the people you're talking to, you can get some feedback from them. You can look out there and see whether they are confused, are they liking it. If they don't like it, you can make adjustments and you can make sure that they're clear on everything. But, you know, as I'm doing this podcast, I'm just looking at a microphone in an empty room. And, you know, from time to time, I might imagine my audience. By the way, you look very good today, looking good. But, you know, I really don't get a sense of what people are thinking about this. Not that that's what this is all about. I'm doing this because it's a lot of fun for me. It's just a hobby. But to know it's helping other people, that's an added bonus. And I really appreciate the cards. Some of you have written reviews on iTunes. I've seen things on Facebook and just your comments. Those of you that I see from time to time, you've been very kind, and it really means a lot. Appreciate it. Keep listening. Spread the word. Let other people know about it. Also, a lot of you have said that you really enjoyed Episode 3, the conversation with Robbie Eversole, and there are more coming up. As I'm recording this, last episode should have been another conversation with my brother Barton. I've got others recorded. Looking forward to releasing those. I got a lot of things planned for you that you'll really enjoy, I hope. We'll mix it up, you know, so it's not just straight series or straight interviews. I'm hoping that variety will keep you listening and keep you interested and keep me interested too. I mean, I need to be interested in this thing to keep it going. Keep the boat afloat, you know what I mean? So we're going to be doing that, but it's time to get back into Judges. We've taken a break on that, and we're getting back to it, and this is episode 7 of the podcast, but I think this will be episode number 3, and I need to remind you of where we were last time. The last time we talked about the Book of Judges, we talked about three in particular, the first three, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. Now, these three belong in a class along with today's judge, Deborah, because they're all unlikely heroes. They're not the kind of people you would expect God to use for deliverance, to use as a judge, to raise up in a time of oppression when God's people need to be delivered. And there's a very special reason why God uses unlikely heroes, and if you don't remember that reason, you can go back to episode 5 where we talk about that. And today we're going to get to it, but I'm saving that a little bit till we get to a particular verse that really highlights that. So I just want to remind you, this ties in to our episode called Strange Deliverance, because Deborah, like Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar, was an unlikely hero because she was a woman living in a day and time where women were oppressed. And I realize there are inequalities still out there today, but they are nothing like they were back in the days of the judges when Deborah was alive. As we get started, I think maybe it'd be a good idea to introduce the cast for today's feature. So if you look at Judges chapter 4, you'll see that the people of Israel are doing evil again. This is after Ehud. And he's gone, and out from under his watchful eye, they go back to their sinful practices. Remember the cyclical nature of this book. They'll go back to it again and again and again, and again and again and again. They'll be thrown into punishment for their sins. So Ehud's gone, and now the oppressor takes the form of Jabin, king of Canaan. Canaan is the general area of the promised land. Canaanites refer to the people who inhabited that land before Joshua and the Israelites were sent to take it over. Jabin is the king of Canaan. He has an army commander, though, named Sisera, who who did most of his dirty work for him. And the people of Israel are oppressed heavily by these people. And they are intimidated by them because they have in their armies, that's Jabin and Sisera, 900 chariots of iron. Iron was hard to come by in those days. You think about what it took in ancient times to make things out of iron. It must have been extremely difficult. So to have 900 chariots of iron was a major military advantage. Not so much in this battle, as we'll see in a little while, but they thought it was an advantage and they used it for intimidation. It's kind of like, have you ever seen Red Square and, videos of Red Square where the Russians or the Soviets would move their tanks and all their arsenal and their missiles and everything through there just to show the world what they had? Well, they probably did that kind of thing with these chariots of iron. They were just as much for propaganda as they were for actual fighting. 20 years, Israel is in this situation under the boot heel of Sisera and Jabin of Canaan. Now, I want to say a couple things about the structure of this particular story that's, to me, very interesting. One thing is it's told in two chapters, which I realize there are other stories that we'll get to that take more than two chapters. But what's unusual about this is it's told in Judges chapters 4 and 5, and basically chapter 5 repeats what we read in chapter 4. Now, there is a difference. Chapter 4 is written in prose, and chapter 5 is written in poetry. And this isn't all that uncommon. You see this kind of thing in the first two chapters of the Bible, really. Not necessarily the poetry, but you see the writer, Moses, here backing up in Genesis chapter 2 to tell, parts of the creation story again and give them a little more emphasis, particularly when it comes to man, to the first man and woman. Some people have said, the first man and woman were created in Genesis 1, and then Adam and Eve came along in Genesis 2, they were not the first man and woman. That doesn't correspond with what the Bible teaches in other places, and it also shows a failure to understand some of the forms of literature that you'll find, not just in the Bible, but in other ancient cultures. They would repeat stories in different ways, and it was a very effective way to teach important lessons. The book of Job kind of does that, where Job chapters 1 and 2 give you the basic story in prose, and then the rest of the book, except for the last chapter, gives it to you in poetry. You have that with regard to the Song of Moses in the telling of the crossing of the Red Sea. So this isn't an unusual thing. It shouldn't have us, take us aback or anything. We're not going to go through the whole thing in both chapters, but I will go to chapter 5 to pick up some things that we may not get, some details that we may not get in chapter 4. So I wanted you to be aware of that. Chapters 4 and 5 kind of repeat one another, but in different ways. Now, another thing that's very interesting is that this story is told in what is known in biblical studies in a chiastic structure. That's based on the Greek letter chi, which kind of looks like an X, so it crosses over on itself, and it's kind of hard to explain without a marker board or something that I can demonstrate with. But I'll give you the structure, and maybe in your mind you can picture that organization and the way that it kind of crosses over itself. Now, in the chiastic structure, a lot of times the center point is the point of the whole thing, is the climax. And listen to this. I think that's the case with this particular story about Deborah and Barak. It starts, the first point in this chiastic structure is in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, Israel oppressed. Secondly, you have Deborah introduced, verses 4 through 9. Thirdly, you have Barak and Sisera, the commanders of the two armies. They are represented by the phrase call out. Barak calls out and Sisera calls out in verses 10 through 13. That brings us to the center point of the whole outline, where God is introduced as a warrior. And you could say that this verse 14, the center of this structure is the key verse of the whole chapter of the whole story of Deborah. Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. These are the words of Deborah to Barak. She's saying to him, you know, the Lord is giving these armies into your hand. You're not doing this. The army's strength isn't doing this. This is by God's power. Now watch how this thing unfolds back out of that structure just the same way that it folded up. It started with Israel's oppression, then an introduction to Deborah, then an introduction to Barak. Then we get to the climax, God as a warrior. He's the one doing the fighting. Now it's going to start unfolding. We're back to Barak and Sisera. Both of them repeated the same phrase. Last time the phrase was call out. This time the phrase is go down. Both of them are described as going down, verses 14 through 16. Next, we're introduced to another woman, parallel to Deborah in the outline. Her name is Jael. She has a very interesting role in this story. She's the assassin, by the way, in the title, The Prophetess and the Assassin. That's Deborah and Jael. And then finally, we end with Jabin, who corresponds to Israel. As Israel was oppressed in the beginning, Jabin, king of Canaan, is subdued by the end. So Jabin, or Canaan, and Israel are parallel. Deborah and Jael are parallel. Barak and Sisera are parallel. And at the center, you have God. I don't think that's a coincidence, you know, the way that that's lined up. That has to be structured in a way to show by the very form of the story that God is behind this whole thing. He's the point. You know, this isn't by the wisdom of Deborah or the military prowess of Barak. This is by the power of God, and he's going to show this in ways other than the form. But I wanted to start out by pointing out the structure so you could keep your eye on it as we go through the story. All right, so let's go ahead and get into the story. We've already kind of introduced everybody. So we can start in chapter 4, verse 4, which introduces us to Deborah in three ways. It says that Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. She used to sit under the palm of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. So she's described in three ways there. First of all, she's called a prophetess, which is just the feminine word for prophet, which corresponds to the men. She had the ability to tell the will of God to the people. She would give messages from God to the people in the same way that Moses did or Elijah or some of the well-known prophets of that time. So number one, she was a prophetess. Number two, she's called the wife of Lapidoth. So it's interesting that she's such a great leader and she's living in this day and age when there is a lot of oppression of women and suppression of women, and she has her husband by her side. A lot of people have wondered, you know, why in the world is this detail in here? Why is it important? Because Lapidoth is not mentioned anymore. He doesn't seem to have any kind of crucial role in this aside from, you know, the domestic life of Deborah. We don't, you know, get, you know, the name of Barak's wife in this, or, you know, later Jael's husband is mentioned, but there's a reason for that. Why is Deborah described as a wife as well as a prophetess? I think the reason it's in here is to show you how ordinary she really is, other than the fact that she was a prophetess and a judge. She was a normal person. She was, you know, someone who led a normal domestic life. She may have had children. If she didn't have them now, she may have gone on to have children later. So she, you know, liked certain foods. She had preferences about things. She had hobbies. She had work that she had to do. She was just a normal person. So maybe that's why that little detail is in there. And then thirdly, she's called a judge. And the judgy part of the judges is probably emphasized more here than in the case of any of the other judges. And we've talked about them before, how the judges were not just judicial in their role, but they would also have military, you know, a military role, a teaching role, a guiding role. She does that, but you see her judging Israel. She sits under this tree. It's a palm. It's called after her name. This is the Palm of Deborah. I can just see people, you know, getting their stuff together as they need to take a case to Deborah. And we're going to travel, and it's going to take us several days. And we need to pack a bunch of sandwiches here to go down to the Palm of Deborah. And then waiting in line to go see this prophetess who is so wise and so respected and honorable and such a great leader with so much influence. I can just see that in my mind's eye. And so she's described, you know, very briefly here, but in such a vivid way. I get a picture of her sitting under that tree judging Israel. Now, this is where the action begins. If you want to pick up in verse 6 with me, she sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, "Has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. And I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and his troops, and I will give him into your hand." So all of that was the word of the Lord coming from the prophetess. Remember, she speaks the Lord's word to him. And she, you know, evidently Barak knew this message. She probably had delivered it to him the first time, and he was being reluctant to follow through. He seems scared about it, reluctant at the very least. And so that comes out in his reply to her. He says, "If you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go." So he believes so much in Deborah that this military commander is telling this woman who sits under a palm tree, "I'm not going into battle unless you are by my side," which is very interesting. And then what she says next is even more interesting, because she says in verse 9, "I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." Very interesting. Now, keep in mind, God could deliver Israel any way that he wanted to. He could deliver them without any human agency whatsoever. Most of the time, he would deliver them through the ruler of that land, or he would raise up a male deliverer. And Deborah is saying, it's not going to happen at your hand. You may be the appointed army commander, but you're not the one. And you might be thinking Deborah is talking about herself, but it will be revealed later that she is prophesying not about herself, but about another woman, a woman named Jael. Why did the Lord choose a woman? Well, precisely the same reason why he chose a Gentile in the case of Shamgar, a left-handed man in the case of Ehud, and an older man in the case of Othniel. All four of these judges start us off on this road, showing unlikely heroes so that we can get it into our minds that the power is not in the people, but in the God of the people. This is God's battle. It's not human deliverance. It's divine deliverance. That's the message, and it comes across very clearly. Now, verse 10 tells us that Barak was able to assemble an army of 10,000 men. When you go into chapter 5 in the song or the poem about all of these things, you see a list of people who bravely answered the call to battle, like Ephraim, the tribe of Deborah, Benjamin is mentioned, Zebulun, Issachar. But then near the end of verse 15, and again, this is Judges chapter 5, we start reading about some tribes and clans that did not answer the call for whatever reason. Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. Now, at first, that sounds really good. Oh, great searchings of heart. But then he says, "Why did you sit still among the sheepfolds to hear the whistling for the flocks?" Among the clans of Reuben, there were great searchings of heart. So that's not a good thing, because while the other tribes were out fighting, Reuben sitting among the flocks, whistling and, you know, thinking and, you know, well, I've got to really think this through before I go into battle. And by the time Reuben got through thinking, the battle was over. And he wasn't the only one. Gilead stayed behind the Jordan. And Dan, why did he stay with the ships? Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, staying by his landings. And then Zebulun and Naphtali are commended for risking their lives to the point of death. So you have all of these tribes that just chose to sit out, and other places too. If you go further in chapter 5, you come down to verse 23. It's kind of a curious little detail here, but it fits in with what we were just talking about. Curse Meroz. We don't know what Meroz. We think Meroz was a village. We don't know its significance. It doesn't really seem to be a part of, you know, an official part of the tribes, but it was expected to come to the aid of God's people. And the speaker here is that angel of the Lord that we've already seen. We were introduced to him at Bochum. He's speaking here about Meroz, this village. Curse Meroz, curse its inhabitants thoroughly, because they did not come to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. So a lot of people just chose to sit out when Barak gave the battle cry. And I think we need to pause on that. Think about that for just a moment, because it's a problem we see today, right? God has called people into service. Churches need help with their mission to make disciples. And only a small fraction of God's people are answering the call. Only a small fraction of God's people are putting out the energy and the sacrifice to go out and do the Lord's work. And there are a lot more people who are enjoying the benefits of that labor, enjoying the benefits of labor they didn't do. I saw some statistics that really shocked me. Actually, it didn't shock me. You know, I see this play out, you know, everywhere. But the Barna Group that do a lot of research, they found that 73% of Americans still profess to be Christians. 73% of people, if you ask them, what's your faith, they would say, well, I'm a Christian. But only about 33% go to church at least once a month. Not once a week, not several times a week, once a month, 33%. And about that same number say that they pray regularly. So there's a huge discrepancy between the number of people who claim to be Christians and the number who say that they pray and attend church. Now that doesn't even get into doing things. You know, that's just about warming a pew and saying a prayer, you know, occasionally. When you get into service, actually, you know, doing something, and the limits on that were very unclear to me, how often that service took place, maybe just, you know, annually or whatever. But only 18% of those people professing to be Christians, only 18% of Americans, 73% say they're Christians, only 18% actually are involved in service in a church, or they'll count a nonprofit organization as well. So those are shocking numbers. There is a huge gap. And, you know, I've been thinking, what explains that? And I have a few ideas, one related to this. You remember, the climax of this story comes in verse 14 when God comes out as a warrior and obviously defeats Canaan for his people. And, you know, the reason God uses unlikely heroes is to make sure everybody knows that he's the one doing the work. When we get to the story of Gideon, he'll reduce the army so that it's obvious he's winning the battle, that they aren't winning it by their own strength. In the book of Joshua, the walls of Jericho come down miraculously so that everybody knows who's really fighting the battle. So this has been drilled into the heads of the Israelites. God is going to do the work. God is going to do the work. It's by the strength of the Lord, by the power of the Lord. And maybe the lack of involvement is from this attitude that, well, if God's the power, then there's really no reason for me to get involved. Could that be maybe one of the reasons? Who knows? I think that very well may be. And I see it echoed over in the New Testament. In 2 Thessalonians, Paul talks a lot about the second coming and some misunderstandings about the second coming and some problems that come up due to teaching on the second coming. And one of the things he mentions is that several of the brethren at the church at Thessalonica had become idle. Special word there. I think it's used in 2 Thessalonians 3:6. Idle, it's sometimes translated unruly. They've become busybodies doing no work at all. They're depending on other people. And it's gotten so bad that Paul said that church had to withdraw from them until they repented of this sin of idleness. Now, why were they being idle? Why did they quit their jobs and let everybody else do the work? They were probably making the excuse that if the Lord's going to return any day now, and Paul never said it would come any day now, he just said, be prepared for that. But if the Lord's going to come any day now, what's the point of me getting a job? What's the point of me doing any work? So why, you know, that's a good question. Why should we do any work at all? It's not to help God. God doesn't need our help. He's God. But there's a very good explanation. The reason God wants us to help is because in helping the Lord, we receive a blessing that we can't receive any other way. I mean, just think about how you feel whenever you make yourself get up and go out and visit somebody, or make a phone call to somebody who's discouraged. You know, it's hard to do sometimes. It's hard to work yourself up to that. But when you finally do it, you feel better. You feel good about doing that kind of thing. When you share your faith with somebody else, you could be very scared about that kind of thing, afraid that you're going to get rejected. And you may get rejected, but after you do it, if you do it with a good attitude and you do it well, you feel really good about that later, and you get stronger, and you have more confidence, and you have more peace in your heart. What's going on there? The service and the evangelism and the compassion, all of that is helping the Lord, not because He needs our help, but because in helping Him, we receive a blessing. He's wanting to bless us through giving us a chance to help Him. So if you're not involved in your church, think about this. We shouldn't operate by selfish motives, but think about this for just a moment. You are hurting yourself. You're hurting your church. You're not hurting God because He can do it on His own. But you're also hurting yourself. Yes, there are people out there that need you, but you need that service as much as they do. So look for opportunities to get involved. They're out there. If you don't know where to start, just go up to an elder or a deacon or a preacher at your church, and I guarantee you they've got something that they need help with, and they can point you in the right direction. There are all kinds of things that you can do. Neglect is very dangerous on a number of counts, but most of all because it robs you of blessings that God wants to give you through service. Well, let's get back to our story here. The actual battle is described in just a few verses. Whenever Barak goes against those 900 chariots of iron, Deborah says in the climax of the story, verse 14, "Up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you?" It says that Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following, and the Lord routed, that word can mean panicked, Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. And then look at this detail. And Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot. Now you're in a perfectly good chariot. It's made out of iron and people are chasing you. Why do you jump out of the chariot and run on foot? There are some theories about this, and most of them come from details that we don't get in chapter 4, but we get whenever we look over at chapter 5. For example, when you look over at the poem in chapter 5, check out verse 4, which says, "The earth trembled and the heavens dropped, yes, the clouds dropped water." Now, remember, they're fighting around this Kishon River, which was really a wadi. I think that's the way you say it. W-A-D-I, a dry riverbed over in that part of the Middle East. So, you know, they weren't maybe counting on this rain. What do iron chariot wheels do in really muddy riverbeds? They get stuck. And you have this again in chapter 5, verse 21. The torrent Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent Kishon. So this is emphasized again and again that there was rain, there was flooding, earthquakes, unusual natural events brought by the Lord to defeat these chariots of iron, aimed specifically at them. And another thing that I really like about this is how it mirrors what happened to the Egyptians in the Red Sea. If you go back to Exodus 14 and read the description there, the same word that's used here translated routed or panicked is used in Exodus 14. God panicked the Egyptians by clogging up their chariot wheels in the mud. So Sisera had to get down out of that chariot and run away because his chariot wouldn't move any longer in that riverbed that suddenly was flooding with water. So he runs off, and he's got a friend that he's hoping to get some help from, a guy named Heber the Kenite. He runs to the tent of the wife of Heber the Kenite, a woman named Jael. Now, she's related to the Israelites. Her people go all the way back to Moses' father-in-law, who was a Midianite. But, you know, she didn't really have a stake in this. Pardon the pun. You'll see that I didn't do that on purpose. I'm not that good. But she decides to take action anyway. Thinking that he's with a friend, he goes to the tent of his buddy's wife here, Jael. She comes out to meet him and invites him in. "Turn aside, my lord, turn aside. Do not be afraid." So he turned aside into her tent, and she covered him with a rug. So she's showing him some care. She's covering him with a rug. He says, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk, gave him a drink, covered him. And he said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent, and if any man comes and asks you, is anyone here, say no." But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. Then she went softly to him and drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died. I don't know if that last detail had to be in there, but just in case you didn't realize that that kind of thing would kill a person, he died. That was the end of Sisera. That's the end of the armies of Canaan. That's the end of the oppression that took out the Israelites for 20 years. So a great battle was won, but not in the way that everybody expected it. They probably expected, and you know, if you can remember back to the first time you heard the story, you probably expected Deborah to be a little assistant to Barak, Barak to be this strong military commander, and God to raise up Barak and lead the people through conventional means to victory. Instead, he helps Barak, he uses Deborah, and then all of a sudden this non-Israelite, Jael, just decides that she's going to side with God's people. And when Sisera trusts her and falls asleep in her tent, she drives a tent peg through his head and kills him and finally defeats the people. Jael is the one who was used to win the battle. So you have the prophetess and the assassin. Glory is a poor motive for doing anything for God. I take you back to verse 9 where Deborah told Barak that she would go with him, and then she said, "Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman." If Barak was in it for his glory, he didn't get what he wanted. He didn't get what he wanted because the glory went to Jael, and really the glory went to God because of using unlikely means to bring about this victory for his people. Anybody who works and operates for their own glory is on a path of foolishness. Just look at the time that has passed since the creation of the world. How many great and wealthy, powerful people have risen and fallen over those days? It's around the 200-year anniversary of one of the most famous poems ever written in the English language, Ozymandias by Percy Bysshe Shelley. Shelley and a friend of his had heard about the discovery of this ancient statue in Egypt. Ozymandias was the, I think, Greek name of it. It could have been Ramses II, who may have been the pharaoh during the Israelite slavery in the book of Exodus. Nobody knows for sure. But this was thought by Shelley, and they decided to have a little contest who could write the best poem about this discovery. And Shelley obviously won. Nobody knows the poem that his friend wrote. But it's enduring because it brings out this idea that if you're going to live for your own glory, you're going to be shown to be a fool down the road. And I think this ties in very well with a lesson learned by Barak, by Jabin, by Sisera, by all of the Israelites in this battle that was won by Deborah and the others. God was the real warrior. Here's Ozymandias. I met a traveler from an ancient land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert. Near them, on the sand, half sunk a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tell that its sculptor well those passions read, which yet survive stamped on these lifeless things the hand that mocked them and the heart that fed. And on the pedestal these words appear, my name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Thanks for listening. See you next time.